Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Man That Casts No Shadow by Seabury Quinn. But no, my friend, Jules de Grandin shook his sleek blonde head decidedly and grinned across the breakfast table at me. We will go to this so kind Madame Norman's tea, of course. A certainty, yes. But hang it all, I replied, giving Mrs. Norman's note an irritable shove with my coffee spoon. I don't want to go to a confounded tea party. I'm too old and too sensible to dress up in a tall hat and a long coat and listen to the vaporings of a flock of silly flappers. I... Mordieu, hear the savage, de Grandin chuckled delightedly. Always does he find excuses for not giving pleasure to others, and always does he frame those excuses to make him more important in his own eyes. Enough of this, friend Tobridge. Let us go to the kind Madame Norman's party. Always there is something of interest to be seen, if one but knows where to look for it. Maybe, I replied grudgingly, but you've better sight than I think you have, if you can find anything worth seeing at an afternoon reception. The reception was in full blast when we arrived at the Norman Mansion in Tuscarora Avenue that afternoon in 1925. The air was heavy with the commingled odors of half a hundred different perfumes and the scent of hot poured jasmine tea, while the clatter of cup on saucer, laughter, and buzzing conversation filled the wide hall and dining room. In the long double parlors, the rugs had been rolled back, and young men in frock coats glided over the polished parquetry in company with girls in provocatively short skirts to the belching melody of a saxophone and the drumming rhythm of a piano. "Pardieu," the grandam murmured, as he viewed the dancers a moment. "Your American youth take their pleasures with seriousness, friend Trowbridge. Behold their faces. Never a smile, never a laugh. They might be recruits on the first parade for all they show joy." He broke off abruptly, gazing with startled, almost horrified eyes after a couple whirling in the mazes of a foxtrot at the further end of the room. "Nom d'un fromage," he murmured softly to himself, "this matter will bear investigating, I think." What's that?" I asked, piloting him toward our hostess. "Nothing, nothing, I do assure you," he answered, as we greeted Mrs. Norman and passed toward the dining room. But I noticed his round blue eyes strayed more than once toward the parlors as we drank our tea and exchanged amiable nothing with a pair of elderly ladies. "Pardon," the grandin bowed stiffly from the hips to his conversational partner and turned toward the rear drawing room. "There is a gentleman here I desire to meet, if you do not mind. That tall, distinguished one with the young girl in pink." "Oh, I guess you mean Count Cesarni," a young man, laden with an ice in one hand and a glass of non-Volstead punch in the other, paused on his way from the dining room. "He's a rare bird, all right. I knew him back in 13, when the Balkan allies were polishing off the Turks. Queer-looking duck, ain't he? First-class fighting man, though. Why, I saw him lead a bayonet charge right into the Turkish lines one day. And when he'd shot his pistol empty, he went at the enemy with his teeth. Yes, sir, he grabbed a Turk with both hands and bit his throat out. Hanged if he didn't." "Cesarni," the Grand Dan repeated amusingly. "He is a Pole, perhaps?" His informant laughed a bit shamefacedly. "Can't say," he confessed. "The Serbs weren't asking embarrassing questions about volunteers' nationalities those days, and it wasn't considered helpful for any of us to do so. Either I got the impression he was a Hungarian refugee from Austrian vengeance, but that's only hearsay. Come along, I'll introduce you if you wish." I saw the grandin clasp hands with a foreigner and stand talking with him for a time, and in spite of myself I could not forbear a smile at the contrast they made. The Frenchman was a bare 5 feet 4 inches in height, slender as a girl, like a girl possessed of almost laughably small hands and feet. His light hair and fair skin, coupled with his trimly waxed diminutive blonde mustache and round, unwinking blue eyes, gave him a curiously misleading appearance of mildness. His companion was at least 6 feet tall, swarthy-skinned and black-haired, with bristling black mustache and fierce slate-gray eyes beneath beetling black brows. His large nose was like the predatory beak of some bird of prey, and the tilt of his long, pointed jaw bore out the uncompromising ferocity of the rest of his visage. Across his left cheek, extending upward over the temple and into his hair, was a knife or saber scar, a streak of white showing the trail of the steel in his scalp, and shining like silver inlaid in onyx against the blue-black of his smoothly pomaded locks. What they said was, of course, beyond reach of my ears, but I saw the Grand Dan's quick, impish smile flicker across his keen face more than once, to be answered by a slow, languorous smile on the other's countenance. At length the Count bowed formally to my friend and whirled away with a wisp of a girl, while the Grand Dan returned to me. At the door he paused a moment, inclining his shoulders in a salute as a couple of debutantes brushed past him. Something, I know not what, drew my attention to the tall foreigner moment, and a sudden chill rippled up my spine at what I saw. Above the georgette-class shoulder of his dancing partner, the Count's slate-gray eyes were fixed on the Grand Dan's trim back, and in them I read all the cold, malevolent fury with which a caged tiger regards its keeper as he passes the bar. "What on earth did you say to that fellow?" I asked, as the little Frenchman rejoined me. "He looked as if he would like to murder you." "Ha!" He gave a questioning smile, syllabled laugh. "Did he so? Obey the noble Washington's injunction, and avoid foreign entanglements, friend Trowbridge. It is better so, I think." "But look here," I began, nettled by his manner. "What—" "No, no," he interrupted. "You must be advised by me, my friend. I think it would be better if we dismissed the incident from our minds. But stay, perhaps you had better meet the gentleman, after all. I will have the good Madame Norman introduce you." More puzzled than ever, I followed him to our hostess and waited while he requested her to present me to the Count. In alone the dancing, she complied with his request, and the foreigner acknowledged the introduction with a brief handclasp and an almost churlish nod, then turned his back on me, continuing an animated conversation with the large-eyed young woman in an abbreviated party frock. "And did you shake his hand?" the Grand Dan asked as we descended the Norman steps to my waiting car. "Yes, of course," I replied. "Ah, tell me, my friend, did you notice anything, peculiar in his grip?" I wrinkled my brow a moment and concentrated thought. "Yes, I believe I did. So, what was it?" "Hanged if I can say exactly," I admitted, "but, well, it seemed—" this sounds absurd, I know, "but it seemed as though his hand had two backs. No palm at all, if that means anything to you." "It means much, my friend. It means a very great deal," he answered with such solemn nod that I burst into a fit of laughter. "Believe me, it means much more than you suspect." It must have been some 2 weeks later that I chanced to remark to the Grand Dan, "I saw your friend, Count Cesarini, in New York yesterday." "Indeed," he answered with what seemed like more than necessary interest. "And how did he impress you at the time?" "Oh, I just happened to pass him on Fifth Avenue," I replied. "I'd been up to see an acquaintance in 59th Street and was turning into the avenue when I saw him driving away from the plaza. He was with some ladies." "No doubt," the Grand Dan responded dryly. "Did you notice him particularly?" "Can't say that I did, especially," I answered, "but it seems to me he looked older than the day we met him at Mrs. Norman's." "Yes?" The Frenchman leaned forward eagerly. "Older, do you say? Parbleu, this is of interest. I suspected as much." "Why?" I began, but he turned away with an impatient shrug. "Bah," he exclaimed petulantly. "Friend Trowbridge, I fear Jules de Grandin is a fool. He entertains all sorts of strange notions." I had known the little Frenchman long enough to realize that he was as full of moods as a prima donna. but his erratic, unrelated remarks were getting on my nerves. "See here, de Grandin," I began testily, "what's all this nonsense?" The sudden shrill clatter of my office telephone bell cut me short. Dr. Trowbridge, an agitated voice, asked over the wire, "Can you come right over, please? This is Mrs. Norman speaking." "Yes, of course," I answered, reaching for my medicine case. "What is it? Who's ill?" It's Guy Eckhart. He's been taken with a fainting fit, and we don't seem to be able to rouse him." "Very well," I promised. "Dr. de Grandin and I will be right over." "Come on, de Grandin," I called as I shoved my hat down over my ears and shrugged into my overcoat. "One of Mrs. Norman's house guests has been taken ill. I told her we were coming." "Ma oui," he agreed, hurrying into his outdoor clothes. "Is it a man or a woman, this sick one?" "It's a man," I replied. "Guy Eckhart." "A man?" he echoed incredulously. "A man, do you say? No, no, my friend. That is not likely." "Likely or not," I rejoined sharply, "Mrs. Norman says he's been seized with a fainting fit, and I give the lady credit for knowing what she's talking about." "Eh bien," he drummed nervously on the cushions of the automobile seat. "Perhaps Jules de Grandin really is a fool. After all, it is not impossible." "It certainly isn't," I agreed fervently to myself as I set the car in motion. Young Eckhart had recovered consciousness when we arrived, but looked like a man just emerging from a lingering fever. Attempts to get a statement from him met with no response, for he replied slowly, almost incoherently, and seemed to have no idea concerning the cause of his illness. Mrs. Norman was little more specific. "My son Ferdinand found him lying on the floor of his bath, with his shower going and the window wide open just before dinner," she explained. "He was totally unconscious and remained so till just a few minutes ago." "Ah, is it so?" the Grandin murmured, half heedlessly, as he made a rapid inspection of the patient. "Friend Trowbridge," he called me to the window, "what do you make of these objective symptoms? A soft, frequent pulse, a fluttering heart, suffused eyes, a hot, dry skin, and a flush, hectic face." "Sounds like an arterial hemorrhage," I answered promptly, "but there's been no trace of blood on the boy's floor, nor any evidence of a stain on his clothing. Sure you've checked the signs over?" "Absolutely," he replied with a vigorous double nod. Then to the young man, "Now, mon enfant, we shall inspect you, if you please." Quickly he examined the boy's face, scalp, throat, wrists, and calves, finding no evidence of even a pinprick, let alone a wound capable of causing syncope. "Mon Dieu, this is strange," she muttered. "Of a surety, it has the queerness of the devil. Perhaps the bleeding is internal, but, ah, regardez-vous, friend Trowbridge." He had turned down the collar of the young man's pajama jacket, more in idle routine than in hope of discovering anything tangible, but the livid spot to which he pointed seemed the key to our mystery's outer door. Against the smooth white flesh of the young man's left breast, there showed a red angry patch, such as might have resulted from a vacuum cup being held some time against the skin, and in the center of the discoloration was a double row of tiny punctures scarcely larger than needle pricks, arranged in horizontal divergent arcs like a pair of parentheses laid sideways. "You see?" he asked simply, as though the queer blood-infused spot explained everything. "But he couldn't have bled much through that," I protested. "Why, the man seems almost drained, dry, and these wounds wouldn't have yielded more than a cubic centimeter of blood, at most." He nodded gravely. "Blood is not entirely colloidal, my friend," he responded. "It will penetrate the tissues to some extent, especially if sufficient force is applied." "But it would have required a powerful suction," I replied, when his rejoinder cut me short. "Ha! You have said it, my friend. Suction. That is the word." "But what could have sucked the man's blood like this?" I was in a near stupor of mystification. "What indeed," he replied gravely, "that is for us to find out. Meantime, we are here as physicians. A quarter grain morphine injection is indicated here, I think. You will administer the dose. I have no license in America." When I returned from my rounds of afternoon calls next day, I found the Grandin seated on my front steps in close conference with Indian John. Injun John was a town character of doubtful lineage, who performed odd jobs of snow shoveling, furnace tending, and grass cutting, according to season, and interspersed his manual labors with brief incursions into the mercantile fields, when he peddled fresh vegetables from door to door. He also peddled neighborhood gossip and retailed local lore to all who would listen, his claim to being 100 years old giving him the standing of an indisputable authority in all matters antedating living memory. "Pardieu, but you have told me much, mon vieux," the grandin declared as I came up the porch steps. He handed the old rascal a handful of silver and rose to accompany me into the house. "Friend Trowbridge," he accused, as we finished dinner that night, "you have not told me that this town grew up on the site of an early Swedish settlement." "Never knew you wanted to know," I defended with a grin. "You know the ancient Swedish church, perhaps?" he persisted. "Yes, that's Old Christ Church," I answered. "It's down on the east end of town. Don't suppose it has 100 communicants today. Our population has made some big changes, both in complexion and creed, since the days when the Dutch and Swedes fought for possession of New Jersey. You will drive me to that church, right away, at once, immediately," he demanded eagerly. "I guess so," I agreed. "What's the matter now? Injun John been telling you a lot of fairy tales?" "Perhaps," he replied, regarding me with one of his steady, unwinking stares. "Not all fairy tales are pleasant, you know. Do you recall those of Chaperon Rouge? How do you say it? Red Riding Hood? And Bluebeard?" "Huh?" I scoffed. "They're both as true as any of John's stories, I'll bet." "Undoubtedly," he agreed with a quick nod. "The story of Bluebeard, for instance, is unfortunately a very true tale indeed. But come, let us hasten. I would see that church tonight, if I may." Christ Church, the old Swedish place of worship, was a combined demonstration of how firmly adhewn pine and walnut can resist the ravages of time, and how nearly 300 years of weather can demolish any structure erected by man. Its rough painted walls and short, firm base spire shone ghostly and pallid in the early spring moonlight, and the cluster of broken and weather-worn tombstones, which staggered up from its unkept burying ground, were like soiled white chicks seeking shelter from a soiled white hen. Dismounting from a car at the wicket gate of the churchyard, we made our way over the level graves, I in a maze of wonderment, the grandin with an eagerness almost childish. Occasionally he flashed the beam from his electric torch on some monument of an early settler, bent to decipher the worn inscription, then turned away with a sigh of disappointment. I paused to light a cigar, but dropped my half-burned match in astonishment as my companion gave vent to a cry of excited pleasure. "Triomphe!" he exclaimed delightedly. "Come and behold, friend Trowbridge. Thus far, your lying friend, the Indian man, has told the truth. Regardez." He was standing beside an old, weather-gnawed tombstone, once marble perhaps, but appearing more like brown sandstone, under the ray of his flashlight. Across its upper end was deeply cut the one word, "Sarah," while below the name appeared a verse, half-obliterated doggerel: "Let none disturb her deathless sleep, about ye tomb wild garlic keep, for if thee wake much woe will boast, pray Father, Son, and Holy Ghost." "Did you bring me out here to study the orthographical eccentricities of the early settlers?" I demanded in disgust. "Ah, bah," he returned, "let us consult the ecclesiastique. He, perhaps, will ask no fool's questions." "No, you'll do that," I answered tartly as we knocked at the rectory door. "Pardon, monsieur," the grandin apologized as the white-haired old minister appeared in answer to our summons. "We do not wish to disturb you thus, but there is a matter of great import on which we would consult you. I would that you tell us what you can, if anything, concerning a certain grave in your churchyard, a grave marked Sarah, if you please." "Why?" The elderly cleric was plainly taken aback. "I don't think there is anything I can tell you about it, sir. There is some mention in the early parish records, I believe, of a woman believed to have been a murderess being buried in that grave. But it seems the poor creature was more sinned against than sinning. Several children in the neighborhood died mysteriously. Some epidemic the ignorant physicians failed to understand, no doubt. And Sarah, whatever the poor woman's surname may have been, was accused of killing them by witchcraft. At any rate, one of the bereft mothers took vengeance into her own hands and strangled poor Sarah with a noose of well-rope. The witchcraft belief must have been quite prevalent, too, for there is some nonsense verse on the tombstone concerning her deathless sleep, and an allusion to her waking from it. Also some mention of wild garlic being planted about her. He laughed somewhat ruefully. "I wish they hadn't said that," he added. "For do you know there are garlic shoots growing about that grave to this very day? Old Christian, our sexton, declares that he can't get rid of it, no matter how much he grubs it up. It spreads the surrounding lawn, too," he added sadly. "Cordieu," the grandam gasped. "This is of the importance, sir." The old man smiled gently at the little Frenchman's impetuosity. "It's an odd thing," he commented. "There was another gentleman asking about her at the same tomb a few weeks ago, pardon the expression, a foreigner." "So?" The grandam's little wax mustache twitched like the whiskers of a nervous tomcat. "A foreigner, do you say? A tall, raw-boned, fleshless living skeleton of a man, with a scar on his face and a white streak in his hair?" "I wouldn't be quite so severe my description," the other answered with a smile. "He certainly was a thin gentleman, and I believe he had a scar on his face, too. Though I can't be certain of that. He was so very wrinkled. No, his hair was entirely white. There was no white streak in it, sir. In fact, I should have said he was very advanced in age. Judging from his hair and face, and the manner in which he walked, he seemed very weak and feeble. It was really quite pitiable." "Sacre nom de un fromage vert," the grandam almost snarled. "Pitiable, do you say, monsieur? Pardieu, it is damnable. Nothing less." He bowed to the clergyman and turned to me. "Come, friend Trowbridge, come away," he cried. "We must go to Madame Norman's at once. Right away. Immediately." "What's behind all this mystery?" I demanded, as we left the parsonage door. He elevated his slender shoulders in an eloquent shrug. "I only wish I knew," he replied. "Someone is working the devil's business, of that I am sure. But what the game is, or what the next move will be, only the good God can tell, my friend." I turned the car through Tunlough Street to effect a shortcut, and as we drove past an Italian greengrocer's, the grandam seized my arm. "Stop a moment, friend Trowbridge," he asked. "I would make a purchase at this shop." "We desire some fresh garlic," he informed the proprietor as we entered the little store. "A considerable amount, if you have it." The Italian spread his hands in a deprecating gesture. "We have it not, signor," he declared. "It was only yesterday morning that we sold our entire supply." His little black eyes snapped happily at the memory of an unexpected bargain. "What is this?" the grandam demanded. "Do you say you sold your supply? How is that?" "I know not," the other replied. "Yesterday morning a rich gentleman came to my shop in an automobile and called me from my store. He desired all the garlic I had in stock, at my own price, signor, and at once I was delivered to his address in Rupleysville the same day." "Ah," the grandam's face assumed the expression of a crossword fiend as he began to see the solution of his puzzle. "And this liberal purchaser, what did he look like?" The Italian showed his white even teeth in a wide grin. "It was funny," he confessed. "He did not look like one of our people, nor like one who would eat much garlic. He was old, very old and thin, with a much wrinkled face and his white hair. He..." "Nom d'un chat," the Frenchman cried, then burst into a flood of torrential Italian. The shopkeeper listened at first with suspicion, then incredulity, finally in abject terror. "No, no," he exclaimed. "No, signor. Santissima Madonna. You do not make the joke?" "Do I so?" Grandin replied. "Wait and see, foolish one." "Santo Dio forbid." The other crossed himself piously, then bent his thumb across his palm, circling it with his second and third fingers and extending the fore and little fingers in the form of a pair of horns. The Frenchman turned toward the waiting car with a grunt of inarticulate disgust. "What now?" I asked, as we got underway once more. "What did that man make the sign of the devil eye for?" the grandam. "Later, my friend, I will tell you later," he answered. "You would but laugh if I told you what I suspect. He is of the Latin blood. and can appreciate my fears. Nor would he utter another word till we reached the Norman house. Dr. Trowbridge, Dr. de Grandin, Mrs. Norman met us in the hall. You must have heard my prayers. I've been phoning your office for the last hour, and they said you were out and couldn't be reached. What's up? I asked. It's Mr. Eckhart again. He's been seized with another fainting fit. He seemed so well this afternoon, and I sent a big dinner up to him at 8 o'clock. But when the maid went in, she found him unconscious, and she declares she saw something in his room. The grandad interrupted. Where is she, the servant? I would speak with her. Wait a moment, Mrs. Norman answered. I'll send for her. The girl, an ungainly, young, southern girl, came into the front hall, sullen dissatisfaction written large upon her face. Now then, the grandin bent his steady, unwinking gaze on her. What is it you say about seeing someone in the young Monsieur Eckhart's room? I see something, the girl replied stubbornly, but I don't care who says I didn't see nothing. And I did. I was just toted a tray up to Mr. Eckhart's room, and when I opened, there was a woman. There was a woman. Skinny, black-eyed woman bending over him. And what, if you please, the grandin asked breathlessly. A biting him, the girl replied defiantly. I don't care what Miss Norman says. She was a biting him. I seen her. She knows what she was. And that Sarah woman that come out of the grave with a long rope about her neck and go around biting folks? Yes, sir. She was biting him, too. I seen her. Nonsense, Mrs. Norman commented in an annoyed whisper over de Grandin's shoulder. Grand Dieu, is it so? De Grandin explained and turned abruptly, leaped up the stairs towards the sick man's room, 2 steps at a time. See, friend Trowbridge, he uttered fiercely when I joined him at the patient's bedside. Behold, it is the mark. Turning back, Eckhart's pajama collar displayed 2 incised horizontal arcs on the young man's flesh. There was no room for dispute. They were undoubtedly the marks of human teeth, and from the fresh wounds the blood was flowing freely. As quickly as possible, we staunched the flow and applied restoratives to the patient. Both of us working in silence, for my brain was too much in a whirl to permit the formation of intelligent questions, while the grandin remained dumb as an oyster. Now, he ordered, as we completed our ministrations, we must get back to that cemetery, friend Trowbridge, and once there we must do the thing which must be done. What the devil's that? I asked, as we left the sick room. No, you shall see, he promised as we entered my car and drove down the street. Quick, the crank handle, he demanded as we descended from the car at the cemetery gate. It will make a serviceable hammer. He was prying a hemlock paling from the graveyard fence as he spoke. We crossed the unkept cemetery lawn again and finally paused beside the tombstone of the unknown Sarah. Attend me, friend Trowbridge, the grandin commanded. Hold the searchlight, if you please. He pressed his pocket flash into my hand. Now, he knelt beside the grave, pointing the stick he had wrenched from the fence straight downward into the turf. With a crank of my motor, he began hammering the wood into the earth. Further and further the rough stake sank into the sod, the grandin's blows falling faster and faster as the wood drove home. Finally, when there was less than 6 inches of the wicket projecting from the grave's top, he raised the iron high over his head and drove downward with all his might. The short hair at the back of my neck suddenly started upward, and little thrills of horripilation chased each other up my spine as the wood sank suddenly, as though driven from clay into sand, and a low, hopeless moan, like the wailing of a frozen wind through an ice cave, wafted up to us from the depths of the grave. Good God, what's that? I asked aghast. For answer, he leaned forward, seized the stake in both hands, and drew suddenly upon it. At a second tug, the wood came away. See, he ordered, curtly flashing the pocket lamp on the tip of the stave. For the distance of a foot or so from its pointed end, the wood was stained a deep, dull red. It was wet with blood. And now forever, he hissed between his teeth, driving the wood into the grave once more, and sinking it a full foot below the surface of the grass, by thrusting the crank handle into the earth. "Come, friend Trowbridge, we have done a good work this night. I doubt not the young Eckhart will soon recover from his malady." His assumption was justified. Eckhart's condition improved steadily. Within a week, save for slight pallor, he was, to all appearances, well as ever. The pressure, the usual early crop of influenza and pneumonia, kept me busily on my rounds, and I gradually gave up hope of getting any information from the Grandin, for a shrug of the shoulders was all the answer he gave to my questions. I relegated Eckhart's inexplicable hemorrhages and the blood-stained stake to the limbo of never-to-be-solved mysteries. But... Part 2. "Good morning, gentlemen," Detective Sergeant Costello greeted as he followed Nora, my household factotum, into the breakfast room. "It's sorry I am to be disturbing you, Mia, but there's a little case puzzling the department that I'd like to talk over with Dr. Grandin, if you don't mind." He looked expectantly at the little Frenchman. As he finished speaking, his lips parted to lunge upon a detailed description of the case. "Parbleu," the Grandin laughed, "it is fortunate for me that I have completed my breakfast. Sure, Sergeant, for a riddle of crime detection is to me like a red rag to a bullfrog. I must needs snap at it, whether it been fed or no. Speak on, my friend, I beseech you. I am like Balaam's ass, all ears." The big Irishman seated himself on the extreme edge of one of my Heppelwhite chairs and gazed deprecatingly at the derby he held firmly between his knees. "It's like this," he began. "'Tis one of the mysterious disappearance cases, gentlemen, and while I'm thinking the young lady knows exactly where she's at and why she's there, I hate to tell her folks about it." "Ah, that high-hat folks ain't like you two gentlemen, asking your pardon, sirs. They mostly seems to think that a harness bull's uniform is something like a livery, like a chauffeur or a footman's or something, and that a plain-clothes man is just a sort of inferior servant. They don't give the police credit for no brains, you see. And one of their daughters gets giddy and runs off with a reservation if we tell them the girl's run away of her own free will and accord. They say we're a lot of lazy, good-for-nothing bums who aren't trying to dodge our late duties by casting mud on the young lady's character. Do you see? So when this Miss Esther's... what's her name? Yeah, Miss Esther Norman disappears in broad daylight, leastwise in the twilight, or the day before her dance, we suspects right away that the girl's gone her own way without the best intentions, you see. But we don't tell her folks as much, or they'll be hollering to the commissioner for to get a brand new set of detectives down to headquarters, so they will. Now, mind ye, I'm not saying the young lady mightn't not been kidnapped, you understand, gentlemen, but I do be saying 'tis most unlikely. I've been on the force, man, for at least in uniform plain clothes for the last 25 years, and the number of legitimate kidnappings of young women over 10 years of age I've seen can be counted on the little fingers of my left hand, and I ain't got none there at all." He held the member up for question, revealing the fact that the little finger had been amputated close to the knuckle. The Grandin, elbows on the table, pointed chin cupped in his hands, was puffing furiously at a vile-smelling French cigarette, alternately sucking down great drafts of its acid smoke and expelling clouds of fumes in double jets from his narrow aristocratic nostrils. "What is it you say?" he demanded, removing the cigarette from his lips. "Is it the so lovely Mademoiselle Esther, daughter of that kind Madame Tuscarora Avenue Norman, who is missing?" "Yes, sir," Costello answered. "'Tis the same young ladies flew the coop, according to my way of thinking." "Mon Dieu!" The Frenchman gave the ends of his blonde mustache a savage twist. "You intrigue me, my friend. Say on, how did it happen and when?" "'Twas about midnight last night. The alarm came in to headquarters," the detective replied. "According to the facts as we have 'em, the young lady went downtown in the Norman car to do some errands. We checked her movements, and here they are." He drew a black leather memorandum book from his pocket and consulted it. "At 2:45 or thereabouts, she left the house, arriving at the Ocean Trust Company at 2:55, 5 minutes before the institution closed for the day. She drew out $330.65 and left the bank, going to Madame Gerard's, where she tried on a party dress for the dance which was being given at her house that night. She left Madame Gerard's at 4:02, leaving orders for the dress to be delivered to her house immediately, and dismissed her chauffeur at the corner of Dean's and Tunlough Streets, saying she was going to deliver some vegetables and what not to a poor family, and she and some of her friends was keeping till their old man gets let out of jail. 'Twas myself and Clancy, my buddy, that put him there, when we caught him red-handed in a job at housebreaking. Well, to return to the young lady, she stopped at Pete Bachelupo's store in Tunlough Street, bought a basket of fruit and canned things at 4:30, and he clamped his long-suffering derby between his knees and spread his hands emptily before us. "Yes, and?" the grandam prompted, dropping the glowing end of his cigarette into his coffee cup. "And that's all," responded the Irishman. "She just walked off, and no one ain't seen her since." "But, Cordieu, such things do not occur, my friend," the grandam protested. "Somewhere you have overlooked a factor in this puzzle. You say no one saw her later? Have you nothing whatever to add to the tale?" "Well," the detective grinned at him, "there are one or two little incidents, but they ain't of any importance in the case as far as I can see. Just as she left Pete's door, an old gink tried to make her, but she gave him the air, and he went off and didn't bother her no more. Like I'd seen the old dog at that. Day before yesterday, there was an old feller hanging around by the silk mills, annoying the girls as they come off from work. Clancy, me mate, saw him and started to take him up, and darn if the old roomie was as strong as a bull. Do you know, he broke clean away from Clancy, and darn near broke his arm in the bargain. Belike 'twas the same man accosted Miss Norman outside Pete's door." "Ah," the grandam's slender white fingers began beating a devil's tattoo on the tablecloth. "And who was it saw this old man annoy the lady?" Costello grinned widely. "'Twas Peter Bagialupo himself, sir," he answered. "Pete swore he recognized the old geezer as having come to his store a month or so ago in an automobile and bought up all his entire stock of garlic." "Huh. The fool said he wouldn't be gone after the feller for $100. Said he had the pink eye or the evil eye or some such thing. The strange man. Dieu le diable." The grandam leaped up, oversetting his chair in his mad haste. "And we sit here like three poissons d'avril, like poor fish, while he works his devilish will on her. Quick, sergeant, quick, friend Trowbridge, your hats, your coats, the motor. Oh, make haste, my friends. Fly, fly, I implore you. Even now, it may be too late." As though all the fiends of pandemonium were at his heels, he raced from the breakfast room, up the stairs, three steps at a stride, and down the upper hall, towards his bedroom. Nor did he cease his shouted demands for haste throughout his wild flight. "Cuckoo," the sergeant tapped his forehead significantly. I shook my head as I hastened to the hall for my driving clothes. "No," I answered, shrugging into my top cap. "He's got a reason for everything he does. But you and I can't always see it, sergeant." "You said a mouthful that time, Doc," he agreed, pulling his hat down over his ears. "He's the darnest craziest frog I ever seen. But, at that, he's got more sense than 9 men out of 10. "To Rupleysville, French Trowbridge," the grandam shouted as he leaped into the seat beside me. "Make haste, I do implore you. Oh, Jules de Grandin, your grandfather was an imbecile and all your ancestors were idiots. But you are the greatest zany in the family. Why, oh, why do you require sunstroke before you can see the light, foolish one?" I swung the machine down the pike at highest legal speed, but the little Frenchman kept urging greater haste. "Sang de Dieu, sang de Saint-Denis, sang de Dieu," he wailed despairingly. "Can you not make this abominable car go faster, friend Trowbridge? Oh, Hellas, if we are too late, I shall hate myself. I shall loathe myself, pardieu. I shall become a Carmelite friar and eat fish and abstain from swearing." We took scarcely 20 minutes to cover the 10-mile stretch to the aggregation of tumble-down houses, which was Rupleysville. But my companion was almost frothing at the mouth when I drew up before the local apology for a hotel. "Tell me, monsieur," the grandam cried as he thrust the hostelry door open with his foot and brandished his slender ebony cane before the astonished proprietor's eyes. "Tell me of whom we yarn, an old man with snow-white hair and an evil face, who has lately come to this so detestable place. I would know where to find him, right away, immediately, at once." "Say," the bonnet-faced demanded truculently, "where'd you get that stuff?" "Who are you to be asking?" "That'll do," Costello shouldered his way past the Grand Dan and displayed his badge. "You answer this gentleman's questions, and answer them quick and accurate, or I'll run you in, see?" Innkeeper's defiant attitude melted the detective's show of authority like frost before the sunrise. "Guess you must mean Mr. Czerny," he replies sullenly. "He comes here about a month ago and rented the Hazeltown house, down the road about a mile. Comes up to town for provisions every day or two, and stops in here sometimes for a—" He halted abruptly, his face suffused with a dull flush. "Yeah," Costello replied. "Go on, say it. We all know what he stops here for." "Now, listen, buddy." He stabbed the air 2 inches before the man's face with a blunt forefinger. "I don't know whether this here Czerny fellow's got a telephone or not, but if he has, you just lay off telling him we're coming, get me? If anyone's tipped him off when we get to this place, I'm coming back here and plaster more padlocks on this place of yours than Sousa's got medals on his blouse. Savvy? Come away, Sergeant. Come away, friend Trowbridge," the Grand Dan besought, almost tearfully. "Bandy not words with this conqueror. We have work to do." Down the road we raced in the direction indicated by the hotel keeper, to the picket fence and broken shutters of the Hazelton house, showed among a rank copse of second growth pines at the bend of the highway. The shrewd wind of early spring was moaning and sowing among the black boughs of the pine trees as we ran towards the house, and though it was bright with sunshine on the road, there was chill and shadow about us as we climbed the sagging steps of the old building's ruined piazza and paused breathlessly before the paintless front door. "Shall I knock?" Costello asked dubiously, involuntarily sinking his voice to a whisper. "But no," the Grand Dan answered in a low voice. "What we have to do here must be done quietly, my friends." He leaned forward and tried the doorknob with a light tentative touch. The door gave under his hand, swinging inward on protesting hinges, and we tiptoed into a dark, dust-carpeted hall. A shaft of sunlight slanting downward from a chink in one of the window shutters showed innumerable dust motes flying lazily in the air and laid a bright oval of light against the warped floorboards. "Huh. Empty as a pork butcher's in Jerusalem," Costello commented disgustedly, looking about the unfurnished room. But the Grand Dan seized him by the elbow with one hand while he pointed toward the floor with the ferrule of a slender ebony walking stick. "Empty, perhaps," he conceded in a low, vibrant whisper, "but not recently, mon ami." Where the sunbeam splashed on the uneven floor, there showed distinctly the mark of a booted foot, 2 marks, a trail of them leading toward the rear of the house. "Right you are," the detective agreed. "Someone left his track here, and no mistake." "Ha!" The Grand Dan bent forward till it seemed the tip of his high-bridged nose would impinge on the tracks. "Gentlemen," he rose and pointed forward into the gloom with a dramatic flourish of his cane. "They are here. Let us go." Through the gloomy hall we followed the trail by the aid of Costello's flashlight, stepping carefully to avoid creaking boards as much as possible. At length the mark stopped abruptly in the center of what had formerly been the kitchen. A disturbance in the dust told where the walker had doubled on his tracks in a short circle, and a ring bolt in the floor gave notice that we stood above a trap door of some sort. "Careful, friend Costello," the Grand Dan warned. "Have ready your flashlight when I fling back the trap. Ready? 1, 2, 3. He bent, seized the rusty ring bolt, and heaved the trap door back so violently that it flew black with a thundering crash on the floor beyond. The cavern had originally been a cellar for the storage of food. It seemed that it was brick-walled and earth-floored, without window or ventilation opening of any sort. A dank, musty odor assaulted our nostrils as we leaned forward, but further impressions were blotted out by the sight directly beneath us. White as a figurine of carven alabaster, the slender, bare body of a girl lay in sharp reverse silhouette against the darkness of the cavern floor, her ankles crossed and firmly lashed to a stake in the earth, one hand doubled behind her back in the position of a wrestler's hammerlock grip, and made firm to a peg in the floor, while the other arm was extended straight outward, its wrist pinioned to another stake. Her luxuriant fair hair had been knotted together at the ends, then staked to the ground, so that her head was drawn far back, exposing a rounded throat to its fullest extent, and on the earth beneath her left breast and beside her throat stood two porcelain bowls. Crouched over her was the relic of a man, an old, old, hideously wrinkled witch husband, with matted white hair and beard. In one hand he held a long, gleaming, double-edged dirk, while with the other he caressed the girl's smooth throat with gloating strokes of his skeleton fingers. "Howly mither!" Costello's County Galway broke through his American accent at the horrid sight below us. "My God!" I exclaimed, all the breath in my lungs, suddenly seeming to freeze in my throat. "Bonjour, Monsieur le Vampire," Jules de Grandin greeted nonchalantly, leaping to the earth beside the pinioned girl and waving his walking stick airily. "By the horns of the devil, but you have led us a merry chase, Baron La Hose Cruscon of Transylvania." The crouching creature emitted a bellow of fury and leaped toward the Grandin, brandishing his knife. The Frenchman gave ground with a quick cat-like leap and grasped the slender cane in both hands near the top. Next instant he had ripped the lower part of the stick away, displaying a fine three-edged blade set in the cane's handle, and swung his point toward the frothing-mouthed thing, which mouthed and gibbered like a beast at bay. "Ah," he cried with a mocking, upward lilting accent, "you did not expect this, our friend blood-drinker. I gave you the party of surprise, n'est pas? The centuries have been long, mon vieux, but the reckoning has come at last. Say, now will you die by the steel or by starvation?" The aged monster fairly chomped his gleaming teeth in fury. His eyes seemed larger, rounder, to gleam like the eyes of a dog in the firelight as he launched himself toward the little Frenchman. The Frenchman sank backwards on one foot, then straightened suddenly forward, stiffening his sword arm and plunging his point directly into the charging beastman's distended red mouth. A scream of mingled rage and pain filled the cavern with deafening stillness, and the monster, half turned as though on an invisible pivot, clawed with horrid impotence at the wire-fine blade of the Grandin's rapier, then sank slowly to the earth, his death cry stilled to a sickening gurgle as his throat filled with blood. "Fini," the Grandin commented, laconically drawing out his handkerchief and wiping his blade with meticulous care, then cutting the unconscious girl's bonds with his pocket knife. "Drop down your overcoat, friend Trowbridge," he added, "that we may cover the poor child's nudity until we can piece out a wardrobe for her." "Now then," as he raised her to meet the hands of Costello and extended into the pit, "if we clothe her in the motor rug, your jacket, sergeant, friend Trowbridge's topcoat, and my shoes, she'll be safe from the chill. Parbleu, I have seen women refugees from the Boche who could not boast so complete a toilette." With Esther Norman, hastily clothed in her patchwork assortment of garments, wedged in the front seat between the Grandin and me, we began our triumphant journey home. "And would you mind telling me how you knew where to look for a young lady, Dr. de Grandin?" Detective Sergeant Costello asked respectfully, leaning forward from the rear seat of the car. "Wait, wait, my friend," the Grandin replied with a smile. "When our duties are all performed, I shall tell you such a tale as shall make your two eyes to pop outward like a snail's. First, however, you must go with us to restore this pauvre enfant to her mother's arms, then to the headquarters to report the death of that sale bête. Friend Trowbridge will stay with the young lady for as long as he deems necessary, and I shall remain with him to help. Then this evening, with your consent, friend Trowbridge, you will dine with us, sergeant, and I shall tell you all. Everything, in total. Death of my life, what a tale it is, parbleu, but you shall call me a liar many times before it is finished." Jules de Grandin placed his demi-tasse on the tabouret and refilled his liquor glass. "My friends," he began, turning his quick, elfish smile first on Costello, then on me, "I have promised you a remarkable tale. Very well, then, to begin." He flicked a wholly imaginary fleck of dust from his dinner jacket sleeve and crossed his slender, womanishly small feet on the hearthrug. "Do you recall, friend Trowbridge, how we went, you and I, to the tea given by the good Madame Norman? Yes? Perhaps then you will recall how at the entrance of the ballroom I stopped with a look of astonishment on my face. Very good. At that moment, I saw that which makes me disbelieve my own eyes, the evidence of my own two eyes. As a gentleman we later met, as Count Cesarni danced past a mirror on the wall, I beheld, parbleu, what do you suppose? The reflection only of his dancing partner. It was as if the man had been non-existent, and the young lady had danced past the mirror by herself. Now, such a thing was not likely, I admit. You, Sergeant, and you too, friend Trowbridge, will say it was not possible, but such is not the case. In certain circumstances, it is possible for that which we see with our eyes to cast no shadow in a mirror. Let that point wait a moment. We have other evidence to consider first. When the young man told us of the Count's prowess in battle, of his incomparable ferocity, I began to believe that which I had at first disbelieved. And when he told us the Count was a Hungarian, I began to believe more than ever. I met the Count, as you will remember, and I took his hand in mine. Parbleu, it was like a hand with no palm. It had hairs on both sides of it. You too, friend Trowbridge, remarked on that phenomenon. While I talked with him, I managed to maneuver him before a mirror. Morbleu, the man was as if he had not been. I could see my own face smiling at me where I knew I should have seen the reflection of his shoulder. Now attend me, the Surete Generale. What you call the police headquarters of Paris is not like your English and American bureaus. All facts, no matter however seemingly absurd, which comes to that office, are carefully noted down for future reference. Among other histories I have read in the archives of that office was that of one Baron Lajo Cruscron of Transylvania, whose actions had once been watched by our secret agents. This man was rich and favored beyond the common run of Hungarian petty nobles, but he was far from beloved by his peasantry. He was known as cruel, wicked, and implacable, and no one could be found who had ever one kind word to say for him. Half the countryside suspected him of being a loup-garou, a werewolf. The others credited a local legend that a woman of his family had once in the olden days taken a demon to husband, and that he was the offspring of that unholy union. According to the story, the progeny of this wicked woman lived like an ordinary man for 100 years, then died on the stroke of the century, unless his vitality was renewed by drinking the blood of a slaughtered virgin. Absurd? Possibly. In an English intelligence office would have said, bally nonsense, if one of its agents had sent in such a report. An American bureau would have labeled the report as being the sauce of the apple. But consider this fact. In 600 years, there was no single record of a Baron Cruscron having died. Barons grew old, old to the point of death. But always there came along a new baron, a man in the prime of life, not a youth, to take the old baron's place. Nor could any say when the old baron had died or where his body had been laid. Now, I have been told that a man under a curse, the werewolf, the vampire, or any other thing in man's shape, who lives more than his allotted time by virtue of wickedness, cannot cast a shadow in a mirror. Also that those accursed ones have hair in the palms of their hands. Eh bien, with this foreknowledge, I engaged this man who called himself Count Czerny in conversation concerning Transylvania. Parbleu, the fellow denied all knowledge of the country. He denied it with more fierce than was necessary. You are a liar, Monsieur le Comte, I tell him, but I say it to myself. Even yet, however, I do not think what I think later. Then came the case of the young Eckhart. He loses blood. He cannot say how or why, but friend Trowbridge, and I find a queer mark on his body. I think to me, if perhaps a vampire, a member of that accursed tribe, who leave their graves by night and suck the blood of the living, were here, this would account for this young man's condition. But where would such a being come from? It is not likely. Then I meet that old man, the one you call Indian John. He tells me much of the history of this town in the early days, and he tells me something more. He tells of a man, an old, old man, who has paid him much money to go to a certain grave, the grave of a reputed witch, in the old cemetery, and dig from about it a growth of wild garlic. Garlic, I know, is a plant intolerable to the vampire. He cannot abide it. If it is planted on his grave, he cannot pass it. I ask myself, who would want such a thing to be, and why? But I have no answer. Only, I know if a vampire have been confined to that grave by planted garlic, then liberated when that garlic is taken away, it would account for the young Eckhart's strange sickness. Tiens, friend Trowbridge. I visit that grave, and on its tombstone we read a verse which makes me believe the tenant of that grave may be a vampire. We interview the good minister of the church and learn that another man, an old man, have also inquired about that strange grave. Who have done this, I ask me, but even yet I have no definite answer to my question. As we rush to the Norman house to see young Eckhart, I stop at an Italian greengrocer and ask for fresh garlic, for I think perhaps we can use it to protect the young Eckhart if it really is a vampire which is troubling him. Parbleu, some man, an old man, have what you Americans call cornered the available supply of garlic? Cordieu, I tell me, this old man, he constantly crosses our trail. Also, he's a very great nuisance. The Italian tell me the garlic was sent to a house in Rupleysville. So I have an idea where this interfering old rascal may abide. But at that moment, I have greater need to see our friend Eckhart than to ask further questions of the Italian. Before I go, however, I tell that shopkeeper that his garlic customer has the evil eye. Parbleu, monsieur, garlic buyer, you will have no more dealings with that Italian. He knows what he knows. When we arrive at the Norman house, we find young Eckhart in great trouble, and a serving maid tells of a strange-looking woman who bit him. Also, we find tooth marks on his breast. The vampire woman, Sarah, is in the very truth at last. I tell me, and so I hasten to the cemetery to make her fast to her grave with a wooden stake, for once he is staked down, the vampire can no longer roam. He is finished. Friend Trowbridge will testify he saw blood on the stake, driven into a grave dug nearly 300 years ago. Is it not so, mon ami? I nodded assent, and he took up his narrative. Why this old man should wish to liberate the vampire woman, I know not. Certain it is, one of that grisly gilder, one closely associated with it, as Discount Czerny undoubtedly was, can tell when another of the company is in the vicinity, and I doubt not he did this deed for pure malice and deviltry. However, that may be, friend Trowbridge tells me he have seen the Count, and that he seems to have aged greatly. The man who visited the clergyman and the man who bought the garlic was also much older than the Count as we knew him. Ah, he is coming to the end of his century. I tell me, now look out for devilment, Jules de Grandin. Certainly, it is sure to come. And then, my sergeant, come you with your tale of Mademoiselle Norman's disappearance. And I too think perhaps she has run away from home voluntarily, of her own free will, until you say the Italian shopkeeper recognized the old man who accosted her as one who has the evil eye. Now what old man, save the one who bought the garlic and who live at Rupleysville, would that Italian accuse of the evil eye? Pardieu, has he not already told you the same man once bought this garlic? But yes, the case is complete. The girl has disappeared, an old man has accosted her, an old man who was so strong he could overcome a policeman. The Count is nearing his century mark, when he must die like other men, unless he can secure the blood of a virgin to revivify him. I am more certain than certain that the Count and Baron are one, and the same, and that they both dwell at Rupleysville. Voila, we go to Rupleysville, and when we arrive there, not one little minute too soon, n'est-ce pas, mes amis? Sure, Costello agreed, rising and holding out his hand in farewell. You've got the goods, Doc, no mistake about it. To me, as I helped him with his coat in the hall, the detective confided. And he only had one shot of liquor all evening? Gosh, Doc, if one drink could fix me up like that, I wouldn't care how much prohibition we had.